there, it's Frank Buckley. This week on the podcast, it's a conversation about a topic we're pretty familiar with here in Southern California. It's animals and our encounters with them. Here in L.A., we see coyotes and skunks and raccoons on a pretty regular basis. In some areas of the Southland, people encounter bears or mountain lions. We're not unique, of course. Around the world and throughout history, humans have lived amongst wildlife, sometimes harmoniously, sometimes with tragic results, and sometimes it's pretty funny. What happens when law and order collides with the law of the wild? That's the question that's explored in the new book, Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law. And I'm delighted to welcome its author, America's funniest science writer, as she's been called, Mary Roach, to the show. Mary, welcome to Frank Buckley Interviews.
Thank you so much, Frank.
So your book is unlike any nature, animal, human book I've ever read. There's a lot of carnage, but it's done in a way that made me want to read more, not turn away. I found myself laughing. Is that wrong?
No, that's absolutely correct. 100%.
But you wrote it that way. You intended for me as a reader to enjoy it with in parts, a smile on my face, to introduce us to these incredible characters, this sort of subworld that many of us don't know about, of people who are involved in the encounter of human and animal.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I like to write with a little bit of humor, and I feel like it just brings people into the topic in a way that it isn't too combative and confrontational. It's because it is kind of a surreal world, and there is a lot of humor because animals, you know, you can't reason with them, you can't sit down and talk to them, so you have to try to persuade them. And in fact, what you're often dealing with is humans misbehaving, who are kind of setting up the problem, and they are also the solution more often than the animals being the solution. So anyway, it's often a funny scenario.
Well, and you say we can't reason with them, but I was shocked to learn there are instances throughout history where they've taken animals to court.
Yeah, I came across this 1906 book called The Criminal Prosecution and Capital Punishment of Animals. And it talks about in the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, that's exactly what would happen. I give this example in the book of these caterpillars in 1659 in Italy that were raiding the crops, as caterpillars will do. They're hungry. There's leaves and lettuce and things. And so they're eating the crops. And so the town fathers put these summonses. They nailed them to trees near these patches of farmland, telling the caterpillars that they were to appear in court on a set date, at which point they would be assigned legal representation. And of course the caterpillars did not show up in court, but there was a legal proceeding, and it was decided, well, we will set aside this land for the caterpillars that is over here, and so everybody will be happy and everything is fair. And of course by that time the caterpillars had pupated and were no longer damaging the crops, so everybody left the proceedings happy and impressed with the powers of the court.
You spent some time writing about bears and mountain lions in your book, and we're very familiar with both here in Southern California. We feature them on our local news on a regular basis. And I want to talk to you about both. First, bears. We love showing them in backyards. They're lounging in pools. we're so used to them here that most people don't fear them at all. Is there any reason to fear these bears that come down from the mountains and rummage through our trash and swim in our pools?
Well, bears they're not aggressive animals. They don't prey on people, obviously. There's a concern if a bear gets used to human-sourced food and is coming regularly into a community and gets bolder and bolder, that they may start actually breaking into homes. I was in Aspen, Colorado, where this regularly happens. The bears are very good at just sort of pulling a door off, and I love that they'll pull it off and just set it carefully aside. They don't hurl it over the side of the deck, but they do regularly go into homes. And now that's when, you know, say somebody is home or they're and they have a dog, and the dog gets upset, and the bear gets freaked out, and the person starts to intervene. That's when people can get hurt.
Yeah.
for the most part, yeah. I mean, a bear wandering through the backyard is kind of a thrill. And I mean, I love bears. I love seeing them. But when people and bears spend too much time in close contact and get too comfortable with each other, then you do have the occasional incident. It's rare, but sometimes happens.
You feature a guy, speaking of Colorado, Curtis Tesh, an employee with Colorado Parks and Wildlife, who's left to deal with these bears, and it has an impact on him. Can you talk to us about him?
Yeah, sure. I drove around with Curtis for a day in Aspen, in Pitkin County, and that day there had been a break-in. So when we went up into the hills and looked at the aftermath, and we were driving around, I asked him, to preface that, when bears in Colorado, when bears do start to break into homes and are coming into close contact with people, they're considered a threat to public safety. And often, especially if the homeowner reports it, a trap is set and that animal, if caught, is destroyed. And I talked to him about what that is like. And keep in mind, people who work for Parks and Wildlife and many of these wildlife agencies, they're people who studied wildlife biology, and they got into this field because they love working in the wild and they love wild animals. And so it's very wrenching for them to be the person who has to destroy that animal. He told me this story about there was a sow, a female, and her cub, which were regularly breaking into homes in the area. And it fell to him to destroy them. And he told me, like, I had to think about, I didn't want the mother to see the child, the baby, the cub destroyed. And I didn't want the cub to see the mother. So I had to think on how to do that. And it was just this wrenching conversation just to hear him talk about that. And on top of that, he gets a lot of hate mail and sometimes death threats from people when an animal is destroyed. Mm. So he kind of gets it from both sides, people complaining about bears, the damage that they're doing. And then people being very angry when one of these animals is destroyed, because people love bears.
Yeah.
So it's so important to use bear-resistant trash containers in a community like that, and to be just cognizant that even something like a grill that's been used to cook meat, that the smell of that is going to attract a bear or other animals as well. So to just try to prevent these situations from happening in the first place.
Let's go to mountain lions. I am not afraid of bears, or at least our local bears, but I am afraid of mountain lions. And I frequently ride my bike through Griffith Park, where we know that there are occasionally mountain lions sighted. And as I'm on a back road by myself, as the sun is going down, I sometimes think, is a mountain lion staring at me and ready to pounce? Is that mountain lion interested in me?
We humans are not on the menu. Mountain lions, they love to eat deer, and smaller animals. They're not interested in us as dinner. But there are situations from time to time you'll hear about. I mean, there was a case of a mountain biker, I'm sorry to say, Frank, that was nabbed. I think it was here in California, I forget. But the thing with mountain lions, and they tell you, if you're confronted with one that seems sort of focused on you, the last thing you want to do is run away or get on your mountain bike and ride away, because that can trigger this predator-prey response where it does come after you. So you're kind of triggering that by running away or riding away. So don't do that.
So I learned in your book that Canadian wildlife experts, when it comes to bears, they say if it's black, fight back. If it's brown, lie down. Is there a similar rule when it comes to mountain lions? What should I do? Am I supposed to make myself big and yell at the mountain lion? Am I just slowly walk away? What's the right behavior?
Actually, the folks in Canada, I mentioned that little jingle that you said, and they said, actually, that's not the best advice, because some black bears are brown and some brown bears are black.
Right.
And they're like, the size of the claws is the best way to tell. And I'm thinking, if you're close enough to be measuring the claws, that's probably not the best way to do it. So they emphasized with both mountain lions and bears to try to discern, is this a defensive attack? In other words, Have I startled this animal, and is it feeling threatened by me? You know, a bear will make a bluff charge. It'll just run at you and try to be really scary and succeed at that, I imagine.
Right.
It'll come at you. And in that case, you know, you want to back slowly away and just show it that you are not a threat, and things will de-escalate and you'll be fine. With, you know, mountain lions, if mountain lions, you know, the ears are flat and it really seems intent on you. You didn't startle it. It's not just a surprise encounter. It actually seems to be stalking you. Then fight back, do anything that you can. You know, aim for the face is always the most, you know, the sensitive area on a bear or a cougar. So, do what you can to fight back and to give it the idea, you know, be loud, be big. Just show it that this is not going to be easy and maybe you want to change your mind.
All right. Well, let's hope we don't find ourselves in that position. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going overseas for human-animal encounters with journalist and science writer Mary Roach.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
That's the handiwork of a professional tree faller taking down a hazardous dead tree in the forests of Canada before it can cause any harm. He's just one of the many Mary Roach that highlights in her new book, Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law. Welcome back to Frank Buckley Interviews. Mary, not every offender you write about is an animal. Some of the deadliest are, in fact, plants. We just showed, as I said, the handiwork of one of the people you feature in the book, a man named Dave Daisy Waymire. Who is he? How did you meet? What does he do for a living?
Well, Daisy Waymire is a danger tree faller blaster. So what he does, and that's a great, faller is a term. In Canada, they tend to call loggers, lumberjacks, they call them fallers. So they have business cards like falling supervisor. So he's a faller, but specifically a danger tree faller blaster. And what he does up in this, there's these groves of these very, very old Douglas firs and other conifers that are some of them are starting to get old and rotten inside, and that makes them unstable. And they're a risk to the public. This is an area where people come to see the trees. They're driving through, they're hiking through, and every now and then one of them has fallen and people have been killed. So they have danger tree assessors, and if the assessor decides this is a danger tree that we have to take action on it, they don't cut it down at the base for a couple of reasons. One, they want to keep that beautiful looking stand of, you know, that they're so tall that even if you blow the top off, people won't notice because it still looks like a big, gorgeous, wide, mossy tree. The other reason is that you can prolong the existence of the tree by just taking off the top. Hmm. It makes it more stable. There's not as much to be blowing in the wind. It's lighter. It's not going to pose a danger. So this guy, Daisy Waymire, I love that it's a lumberjack named Daisy. It's actually D-A-Z-Y.
Right.
It's kind of like a boy named Sue. Anyway, so he will climb up about two-thirds of the way up and drill holes, put dynamite in there. And then we all, you know, everybody, he comes back down, spools out the detonating cord, and from a few hundred feet away, blows off the top of the tree.
Amazing.
And, yeah, it's quite a sound. Yeah.
Let me take you overseas. I was surprised to learn in your book that we think of elephants as these beautiful, magnificent creatures. People are trying to save elephants around the world. But in India, elephants kill 500 human beings every year?
That's apparently the statistic. Yeah, there are a lot of elephants in India, and they're not, you know, stalking people and killing them for food, obviously.
Right.
What's going on with these animals? They travel in large social groups, family groups, and they if they come to a village where someone's growing crops, which often people are, they're kind of family plots or village plots where they're growing vegetables and things that they live on. The elephants come through, and you can imagine a group of 10 elephants, even if they're not eating, just walking through is going to cause considerable damage. But they often are also eating the crops, and so people run out. They're upset. It's often after dark mm-hmm. when the elephants come through, so they'll come out with firecrackers or with torches with flames, and they'll they're attempting to scare the animals off. But what happens is that the it breaks apart the social group. And when that happens with elephants, they get panicked, huh. They freak out, they start running around, they stampede, and you've got three or four people in the field with them. It's it happens very often that someone will get trampled
wow.
or just knocked over. It's almost like getting hit by a truck. You know, if you've got a running elephant that
yeah.
hits you, you're not going to be in good shape. So it is a big problem.
Right.
There. Elephant safety, yeah.
Yeah, less frightening in India, the monkeys. And you say that these monkeys enjoy harassing people.
Well, that was the researcher's conclusion.
Right.
He woke up one morning in bed with a monkey on his chest, looking at him in the face. And then it's like there was this standoff, and then he pulled the covers down. The monkey ran off. But he said, one time they came into his kitchen, he said they took the induction cooker and just threw it on the ground. They took no food. They just lived to harass you. He hates monkeys.
Staying overseas, there's a story here that we found fascinating. The Great Emu War of 1932. What was that?
Yeah, that was in Western Australia, and this was a bunch of wheat farmers who were losing a lot of their crop to a mob of emus, a big group of, emus coming in and eating the crops. And they called on the military. First, they wanted to borrow some machine guns, and the Australian military said, no, you cannot borrow our machine guns, but we will send some machine gunners down. And they did. They sent a General Meredith and his men who showed up and who set up their machine guns. I won't tell the whole story, but
right.
I'm just going to say the emus won.
Wow,
the emus won. General Meredith and his men eventually retreated along this road, and apparently all the emus were standing along the road as if wishing them a mocking farewell. So that one ended well for the emus.
One more I want to get in. We only have a minute here. Second Battle of Midway. You reference an old Navy film strip in this book. We found that film strip, and I want to show it to our viewers. What was the Second Battle of Midway all about, and who were our enemies at that battle?
Yes. Well, when the Navy came in and built a base, lots of flights going in and out, and there were birds there, a lot of seabirds, a lot of albatross. And the Navy figured, oh, they'll leave once we start flying planes in and out. But they didn't. The albatross are just like, okay, there's a large metal bird, whatever, I'll share the space. So the Navy tried everything, bazookas, rifles, pistols, mortars, burning tires, tripping them. They tried basically everything. And the albatross would not leave.
Well, let's take a look at the film strip real quick.
In spite of the most strenuous efforts and craftiest schemes to divert them to the other more desirable islands nearby, they get more stubborn and run rampant in anger by attempts to oust them. Such determination used to bring about laughter. But the Cold War has changed all that.
Who won that one?
You know what? To this day, the albatross are still there. The Navy is gone and the albatrosses remain.
All right. We're going to take one more short break when we come back, and more with author and journalist Mary Roach.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about all from the comfort of your home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome back to Frank Buckley Interviews. We're here with Mary Roach. Mary, here in California, here in L.A. County, in fact, we're starting construction soon on a wildlife bridge over the 101 freeway with the idea that the animals that are in the Santa Monica Mountains need to cross, and there's no natural way for them to do that without crossing the dangerous 101 freeway, or in some cases the 405 freeway. We hear about mountain lions being killed. Is this, it seems to represent some sort of a fundamental shift in how we think about this interface between humans and wildlife. Is it a good solution?
It's a great solution. I'm glad I didn't actually realize that that was being built, but that's fabulous. Not only because mountain lions get killed, but because they get isolated, and so that their genetic health suffers. They start inbreeding because there's not enough mixing. So that's fabulous news.
Some people think, what a waste of money. They're animals. All that money could be used to help human beings. To that, you would say what?
Oh, come on. Spare a few bucks for the cougars. I know. That gets people have that response, and I know that. But I also think, if you can you prove to me that if you take that money, is it definitely going to be spent on something like education or health? I don't know. Just like any time you can do something worthwhile with money, just go for it.
Does it make sense? Will the mountain lion find that bridge? Will they realize, oh, that's for me? And how do they know?
Yeah, you can go online and find these amazing videos of animals crossing over wildlife bridges. I mean, they're all over the country and the world. There's a lot of them in Europe as well, and you'll see them. You'll see the animals using it. It's wonderful to watch that footage.
Yeah. The National Park Service recently captured its 99th lion as part of a study into their population in the Santa Monica Mountains. The feeling that I think that we get here is that the population is dwindling, but statewide it's actually growing, isn't it?
There's a survey going on now of all the counties in California, and I spent a day with one of the main people, Justin Dellinger, who's been doing that survey for California Department of Fish and Wildlife. And their estimate right now is that there are around 5,000, which is around what the last count was a little rough, but it was around 4,500, I believe. So it's pretty. It's pretty constant, the number, since the last time the survey was done. It's funny, there are people who think that they're severely endangered, and then there are people who think they're 10 times as many because we have all these doorbell cameras, and so that people are seeing footage, which gives them this impression that cougars are everywhere.
Right.
It's kind of like when mammograms came out, people were like, breast cancer rates are spiking. It's, well, no, we're detecting a lot more than
right.
we used to. So the doorbell cams are kind of the mammograms of wildlife science. But the population appears to be fairly steady.
You know, some people think about these mountain lions, as I said to you, I confess that I personally fear them. And some people think, look, apex predators like mountain lions, like great whites. Why do we need them in the ecosystem? They're a threat to me. Can you explain why these apex predators, like mountain lions, are important?
Well, I don't think they're a threat to you, Frank. I mean, a decade will go by in California where no one is killed by a mountain lion. You're more in danger of deer, swerving to avoid hitting a deer. Far more people are killed that way. Dogs kill, 15 or more people a year, snakes. So really, take mountain lions off your worry list.
Okay.
You are not going to be killed by a mountain lion. I think that there's been a shift in, in the public consciousness in terms of what these animals represent. In the 1800s and through the first half of the 1900s, they were widely just considered varmints and competition for hunters and a damage to the bottom line for ranchers and people, small scale farmers as well. So over time, people have, there's been the emergence of conservation groups and animal welfare. And so there's been this shift to just value, seeing them as having an intrinsic value for their own, for their beauty and their otherness, and to lose any species feels like, to me anyway, a terrific loss. And they do, there's a whole system of checks and balances. When you remove one animal from an ecosystem, another population, you're going to see more deer because mountain lions, their sort of favored prey is deer, and then you start to have too many deer. So anytime you pull one link out of the system, you never quite know what the results are going to be, and it's best not to have that happen.
You were talking about Curtis Tesh earlier, and the effect of what he does and how it affects him personally. And it really was a revelation to me, because you do look at these folks and they might be out there tranquilizing an animal, and in some cases having to destroy an animal because it has attacked a human being. And you think, and people have, they ascribe whatever their personal feelings are to that particular person. And you forget that, as you say, a lot of these people get into this because they love animals. They love being in nature. They really embrace it, and it's sort of the last thing they want to do.
Yeah, and it's especially frustrating to them because they know that the reason this animal is being destroyed is not because it's some sort of miscreant, aggressive, serial killer type creature. It's because we humans have encouraged it to come into our world. We've offered it food unwittingly or intentionally. We've encouraged the animal to be in close proximity to us, and that's when this trouble starts to begin. So it's very frustrating. These people spend a lot of time on outreach, on trying to educate people on, their slogans like a fed bear is a dead bear. They do everything they can to kind of keep people from doing this so that they don't have to destroy these animals. And it's very it's very emotionally difficult for them when they have to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Mary, this has really been interesting to me. I suspect for you as a writer to enter these worlds must be fascinating as well, to meet these human beings. How do you gain their trust so they don't think that you're writing about them as if they are the object of a joke, but that you're writing about them so that you appreciate what they do? How does that happen?
Well, I contact them, and if they don't know who I am and they've never read any of my books or even heard about any of them, one thing I try to do is send them a book. I don't want anybody taken by surprise. I don't want them to think, oh, I thought you were writing a textbook.
Right.
I want them to know, that this is my goal. This is what I do and how I do it. So I'll talk to them on the phone. I'll put them in touch with other people who've been in my books. If they'd like that, send them a copy of whatever book they'd like to read, and that way just give them time to kind of think about it.
Does it still amaze you after all these years of writing about these kinds of things? Are you still surprised at the people that you meet and the experiences that you have, like the one in Canada at the conference where you have to straddle, I think it was a mannequin of a dead body to get to the buffet line?
I never know what I'm going to get into when I start these books, and that's why I love it. It's just like somebody giving me the key to a door, and I don't really know what's back there, but I know it's going to be a really fun ride and just really interesting. And like you said, this is a book, it's about people and animals, but it's really about the people that I meet. The animals are not very quotable and a little bit hard to interview. So it's all about these people and how they try to manage these things and and what their day-to-day life is like. And it's so interesting.
I'll put you on the spot and ask you if there is one person or one surprise or one thought that stays with you after writing this book, a story that one cornered at a cocktail party that just keeps coming up for you?
Well, this sounds really silly because I live in Northern California. We don't have bears, but the moment that stayed with me was just in that alley at 3 a.m. in Aspen behind where the restaurants are. I mean, I had one day to have a bear encounter. You can't cue the animals, but so I convinced the researcher to set his alarm for 3 o'clock, and we went out there and I thought, well, I'm not going to see anything. We pull up, there's the bag of garbage ripped open, spilling onto the street. And he said, just wait, they'll be back. And we pulled over, 10 feet away, and this bear comes down, just lumbering down the alley. And then another one joins him. And, we're standing like 10, 15 feet away from these bears. And it was both thrilling for me as someone who has never been in close contact with a wild bear. It was both thrilling, but just also heartbreaking because I knew what the likely fate of these two animals was going to be. So the emotions of that moment, I think, stay with me.
Yeah. And in fact, I believe that the researcher, if I remember that correctly, was kind of angry when you guys pulled up and he saw that. And you also mentioned in that section the idea that some restaurant has a grease trap or something that is in an alley and the bears frequently just walk away from that covered in grease.
Yeah, he said it's about the size of a drinking fountain. It's just, cooking grease. They dump it in there. And he said the bears just basically use it as a drinking fountain because what better source of calories than a big vat of oil? And he said he's seen bear footprints in grease leading away from that container down the alley. Yeah.
And the point And the point is that that's not a good thing, that this ultimately, even though the bear may be sated at the moment, is going to threaten that bear in the end.
Yeah, that's why he was so mad. I mean, there's been so much work done to try to, they put legislation in place, but then we walked up and down that alley and either the locks were broken on some of these containers or they were left open or people had thrown compost bags into the recycling dumpster, which is not secure, doesn't have to be secured because it's supposed to be just paper and cans and things. So just 5 or 6 instances all up and down that alley that should have been fixed or ticketed, and the fines weren't being levied, the laws weren't being enforced, and just frustrating because so much work by people who care about the bears, so much work is done to try to educate people and put the solutions in place, and it's more complicated than you would think, and more difficult, and I understood why he was angry.
Yeah. As we think about these interactions between humans and animals and the fact that we continue to encroach more and more on their territory, are there things that we should be keeping in mind as human beings as we engage in development in these areas?
Yeah, I think the more that you can keep this in mind. For example, even when you're putting when you're putting roads and freeways in, that's the time to think about it. Is this the smartest? I mean, by putting this road here, are we isolating animals that need to migrate for food? Herds of animals, sometimes that happens. So the more you can prevent these problems, the better, rather than trying to find expensive solutions. So just keeping it in mind all the time is the best way to kind of prevent these conflicts.
Well, it's a fascinating book, Mary. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
And my thanks again to Mary Roach. The book, once again, is Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law. We drop a new podcast every Wednesday. We air a new TV show every weekend. And, of course, I love your feedback. You can tag me on social media at Frank Buckley TV on Instagram and on Twitter. And there's a Frank Buckley Facebook page as well. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. And until next time, I'll see you on TV.